Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labour and my leisure too, for his civility.
So where we are is in the middle of sheep farming country, and it's open farmland, it's pasture land mostly. Field over there that's been just being cut for hay or silage, not sure which.
We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries. And yet feels shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. A poem by Emily Dickinson.
My name is John Burnside. I'm a poet, novelist, essay writer. We're sitting in my studio in my overgrown garden in East Fife, in the midst of farmland, just above the Firth of Forth. It was 2 years ago. I had had heart failure. But also, there was some kind of complication with my lungs. Things begin to be hazy from my memory. I can remember getting into the ambulance.
Right, we're going to get you onto the ambulance now, mate. Have a look at you, OK?
And the guy saying, we're going to lie you down.
Keep yourself covered up.
I don't remember arriving at the hospital, but all I know is that they still thought I was a COVID patient. Ended up in the COVID emergency room. And the next thing I remember was just being surrounded by people in really heavy-duty PPE. I could see them around me, and they were obviously very concerned. I was lying flat, looking up at them around me. They were like giant bugs. They had ant heads. The reason for the hallucinations was because there was so much carbon dioxide in my bloodstream. And I actually thought I was in some kind of William Burroughs-type scenario. I thought it was something like the Naked Lunch or something.
Make an incision, Dr. Limp. I'm going to massage the heart.
These guys were all kind of coming to work on me, and I didn't find it scary, but I found it kind of bemusing. John? Is it John? And I'm kind of, yeah, I think it is. I've got a feeling.
Did I ever tell you about the time I performed an appendectomy with a rusty sardine can?
This was now about the evening time of that day. My wife phoned up and they said, just prepare for the worst. One of the doctors who was there later on told me that they had decided that I was going to die and that I was going. They actually put a DNR on me, do not resuscitate. And they said, you know, there's no point in prolonging the pain if we try and bring him back. We'll just let him go. And then, I'm not saying I had an out-of-body experience, but then I saw it from the outside. They had taken my clothes off. I just saw myself as this big, huge slab of meat lying on this table. And I was somehow detached from it, as if you were watching it on a movie screen or something like that. Out of that came the poem. The anatomy lesson of Dr. Willem van der Meer. Willem van der Meer was an early pioneer of anatomical research. No one believes in heaven anymore. Only the burden of air forced from the lungs, equivalent in weight to certain songbirds, say a goldfinch or a wren. Too small and oddly formal, white as frost, the corpse lies gaping on a wooden board, a stillness that no calculus could measure. The most famous anatomy lesson, there's lots of anatomy lesson paintings. The most famous one is the one of Rembrandt. But I wanted this one because this one actually shows the incisions, and that's part of the image, was trying to make it more like, as it were. As strange to the light as if they were contrived of rope and wax, the innards are laid bare to let whatever spirit they might hold unravel from the flesh and bleed away. Someone has covered the face with a scrap of gauze. Beyond the windows, in the smoke and gold of Hallow Mass, the living go en masse from house to house, their faces painted on in likenesses of what they love or fear when night comes. Ghosts suspended in midair, the feel of someone watching, nothing there. That was me lying there, but I looked at that thing I was seeing as it were from the outside, this body lying there. I'll never forget it. It was kind of gross to me. I thought, this piece of meat is dying. Then there was this feeling of, you know, not being able to breathe. I would say that's much worse than pain. The distress of not being able to breathe, that's something else. It's a panic that goes with that, because it was just so intense. And then the thought came, oh, I'm going to die, because when you stop breathing, you die. And it stopped, the distress stopped. It was a feeling of detachment, complete and utter detachment from everything. My heart stopped, and breathing stopped. They then decided, no, this is it, he's gone, and we'll leave him.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. And immortality.
Well, I always liked that poem because I love Emily Dickinson, but I like the part where she says, I put away my labour and my leisure too.
I had put away my labour and my leisure too.
You put everything aside, you lose your attachments. You say, yeah, I'm ready to make this journey, wherever it's going to lead me. And that was when, not just a vision, but a sensation of being completely surrounded in light. Not in it, but with it, or part of it. The light was as much me as I was, you know. There was no differentiation. And there was no features other than just light. And it seemed to be everywhere, going on forever. Very, very calm, with a hint of something like almost gold in it. And when you say light, you always think it's a visual thing. But it was like everything was light. It wasn't just, you know, something you saw. It's hard to express this because it's a very wordless kind of thing. Extremely peaceful.
I've talked to thousands of people who've had these experiences. I'm Dr. Penny Sartori, and I'm senior lecturer in adult nursing at Swansea University. And my background is nursing. I worked in intensive care for 17 years. I undertook a research study for my PhD into near-death experiences. So it might begin with an out-of-body component where the person feels that they leave their body and they look down on the emergency situation from above. Some people feel that they're drawn towards a very bright light, and although this light is bright, it doesn't hurt their eyes, and sometimes it's described as having a magnetic quality, so they're very much drawn into this light. And sometimes when they get into the light, they'll meet deceased relatives or friends. They might find themselves in beautiful gardens with lush green grass, vividly coloured flowers. They might come to a barrier or a point of no return. And very often the relatives or friends that they meet will tell them that it's not their time, that they have to return. And sometimes they have a life review.
The one thing I did feel was a sense of being on the point of becoming the light, kind of dissipating somehow into the light. I was upset that my children the boys wouldn't be able to see me and I wouldn't be able to say goodbye to them. But I just had this feeling of, yeah, it's okay, don't worry. It was almost like, that's his problem, the old me.
They're so overwhelmed and engrossed in this experience that other things that factor into their life that are very important to them usually become less important because the focus changes. So, for example, I've had lots of mothers who have had their near-death experience during childbirth and they've been quite happy and content to stay where they are because it's such an overwhelming experience. Now, when they return to life, that's often associated with a lot of guilt because they were prepared to go on and die, in effect, and leave their loved ones behind. Some of these experiences can actually be hell-like as well. They look into hell, they might feel the heat, the flames rising from hell. They might feel that they're being dragged down by demons. And they can evoke almost like a post-traumatic stress as well when they think about these experiences.
One thing I related to was when I used to take LSD. An essential part of it, which is the same, and it's that sense of something larger, something mysterious. You're left with something. It's like, I felt things to be true during that time that I still feel to be true. I know something now.
There's a lot of work being done with microdosing LSD. Certainly back in the 1960s, William Richards and Stanislav Grof have done some work with patients who were terminally ill, and that proved to be very effective with reducing anxiety as people were approaching death. This isn't endorsed during everyday life because these were done under fully controlled conditions. So, you know, this is something that you can't just go out and do this. This is something that needs to be done in a controlled environment. You could evoke similar kinds of experiences in deep meditation, but the near-death experience is totally in a different context because it's not expected. It takes people unaware. It's very spontaneous. There are a few suggested explanations, but there is no one neurophysiological, there's no evidence to say what this near-death experience is.
What's interesting about that for me is the whole question of brain-mind. And there are people who are very insistent in saying, look, if this chemistry of your brain isn't doing these things, then you're no longer mindful, aware, what the right word is. And it seems to me clear that there have been people who observe things and remember things to that point. So there's something about mind which is different in some way from that kind of very mechanistic view of brain.
Current scientific understanding is that consciousness arises from the brain, but these experiences actually make us question that. So it makes far more sense to consider consciousness as primary rather than the brain producing consciousness.
Philosophers and poets throughout history have said pretty much this. Yes, of course, reason is a hugely important thing. We live the way we live. We're decent towards each other, mostly because of reason, deductive thinking, that kind of thing. But there's something else going on. There's something, other faculties that we use all the time that our science denies that they have any validity at all. Intuition, for example. You know, I constantly intuit things that I couldn't explain to anybody, and they end up in a poem or something, or, you know, they end up informing something. Should I deny them because I can't explain them scientifically? It's another faculty. Imagination. What is imagination?
I was thinking today, as I noticed that the supernatural was only the natural disclosed. Emily Dickinson, February 1863.
In other words, What we call the supernatural is the thing that hasn't been disclosed to our minds yet. There are things that we can know without being able to paraphrase them, and that's what poetry does. It's the art of saying what we can't paraphrase, if you like, and say, it's there. Deal with it as you want to deal with it. I'm dealing with it this way. I have no memory of coming back. You know, you have an image of something like this, you're kind of breathing again, but I have no memory of that. And, you know, I was back in the world again, as it were. I felt as though I'd been somewhere and I wasn't quite sure where. It's just a huge effort just to keep on breathing. Just breathe, 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 breathe. I just felt this amazing kind of, yeah, everything's okay. And I'm usually very restless, and I was just very calm, and I'm just lying there for what, 6 days or something. There was one point I kind of felt as though it went under and came up again quite soon, drifting into a kind of hypnagogic state. And there are all these phrases in my head, and I couldn't make any sense of them. And the nurse had given me the phone earlier on, so I typed these words, not really with a sense of cogent phrases, but just word after word that come into my head, but just something that had come up to the surface during that time. Out of that came the poem, Ma Bohème. It's about 6 or 7 lines of it. Here are the references in this to Rambo and his work, to French culture generally, to the Tao Te Ching of Chinese philosophy, to tarot. A large part was about breathing. And of course, a poem is a breath, a long breath in some cases. Lots of references to environmentalism and also Catholicism. It's a little bit mysterious. And it echoes that practice of Rambo, having this imagery proliferating down the page, you know. Ma Bohème. After Arthur Rimbaud. No catechism here, no sunken church, and yet it seems this mystery is ours as ruins are, a counterpoint to grace, where each thing hunts its echo, fish then fowl, first one and then another, little owl and vixen, herons stock still in the reeds, the stoat unclasping from its lookout in the wall, a thinning streak of mastery and venom. The silk road is gone from our hearts, a final spindrift under the concourse of Yorkstone and Canberra.
Ma Bohème by Arthur Rimbaud, 1870. Off I went, hands thrust in torn pockets. My overcoat, too, more idea than fact.
There's something about Rimbaud's kind of childlike spontaneity and openness.
Starry-eyed Tom Thumb, I strewed my path with verse. I laid my head at the inn of the Great Bear. My stars swished softly in the sky. And sitting by the roadside, I listened to them on fine September evenings when I felt dewdrops on my forehead like invigorating wine. And rhyming verse among the phantom shadows like lyre strings. I plucked the laces of my beaten-up boots, 1 foot close to my heart.
When I left the hospital, I said to the nurses, I just wanted to say thank you for everything you've done. I said, don't say thank you. We thought you'd died, and you came back again. first signs of snow on the high road, the last of the traffic making for home, wet blister packs of search lamp in the dark, flatbeds and semis loaded with gravel and lumber, a last bus bound for the depot at who knows where. And I go my way, learning to breathe like a seventh sun, and the murmur of stars in my blood, till the night dew falls through the trees like ice on my skin, sweeter than ruin and cool like a fine young wine. My wife drove us home, and I was just looking out the window in all the gardens. There were cherry trees in blossom, you know, cherry trees being the standard flowering tree in suburban gardens. And I remembered that there was a great painting by George Shaw, the painter George Shaw, called Blossomiest Blossom. It's like one of those little cherry trees in a working-class housing estate. But George got that title from Dennis Potter's last interview, and he knew he was dying, and he looked out the window and he saw this tree, and he just had the sensation of it was the blossomiest blossom that he'd ever seen. And I just thought, yeah, it's blossom time. I used to sit here in this garden and just felt really kind of blessed by it for, you know, a few weeks after that. And I was sitting and just listening to the bees winding through the grass and watching butterflies.
After the near-death experience, their senses seemed more heightened, so they might see colours in a much more vibrant state than they do normally. Their hearing might be much better than it has been usually.
People look at buzzards and they think they see this big, bulky kind of bird. It's got this high-pitched, soft, quite gentle, eerie kind of call. And it's often nice to sit down here. What you're looking for is just that sense of connection with the earth, you know, and water and the weather. I just felt good about everything. It was beautiful. It was like halcyon days.
People can feel a state of serenity and peace for quite some time afterwards. It does tend to fade over time, but it can last, not constantly, but they can dip in and out of it for a few years.
The doctors were saying, you know, you've still sustained a lot of damage to your heart and it can't be mended. So I'm thinking, well, it probably means that, you know, it won't be long, necessarily, not months, but probably just a few years, maybe, who knows. When I do die, how can I explain it to the people I love that it's okay? Of course, people mourn people who they lose, but I wouldn't want somebody mourning for me because I know that somehow I'm not personally going on to a better place. I'm not against that idea. I just don't have any evidence for it. But there's something about life itself that includes me, includes you, includes everybody. Somehow, the energy that made me who I was now will somehow be reassumed into the kind of general flow of it all. You know, that's how I feel. But that's probably as mystical as I would be wanting to get. It's a continuum. That's okay, you know, as long as somebody is going to be there. Preparations for the true apocalypse. We have come to the last bohème of being here, and still no guarantee of other bodies pressing through the fog to meet us. Harvest at last, or else an early frost. No alchemy so tender as the nub of ruin, where the first plums start to fall in long abandoned orchards. Stray anemones and houseleeks in the weeds, a minaret of wasps between the trees. Imagine how it looks when we are gone. The other presences so well achieved, they want for nothing. Goldcrest in the pines, the larger fauna, ponies out to grass. And everything that might have been undone, resuming in the gaps we leave behind. Wave after wave of brightness on the land.
many people seek ways of expressing their experience through art. You know, some people paint and they draw. Some people write poems, music, write songs. Some people write books. But if they get a dismissive response or if someone laughs at them, very often they'll never talk about the experience again. Very often they feel very isolated because the person's values change as a direct result of their near-death experience.
You think, can I go back to being that person that I need to be to earn a living and to get on with people? Can I go back to that? I'm not sure I can pull it off. And then, of course, you realise you have to. But there's also that feeling of, I'm losing something. I'm losing those confirmed belonging to something. They're taking it away from me. And then I came to a point relatively recently still, this is 2 years later, of thinking, no, it's still there. I can get back to it. I stop for a moment and I just close everything else off and remember what it was like. And I'm talking about memories, that many of which are only half there. But the ones I do remember are, of course, the ones that are really define what happened. I would sum it up by that sense of peace. And actually, recently, I've been able to do that. I've started writing new work again, poems that are coming out of new experiences that are hopefully reflecting that in some way. Postscript. An evening like any other. Storm clouds stalled above the fields. My neighbour's cattle gathered at the near edge of their known dominion. One last tractor dawdling to the yard, its headlights blurry in a burst of summer rain. And something's coming. Something sensed but not yet seen before the night engulfs us and the cattle turn away, bemused or unconvinced or simply waiting for this weather to be done. And I am with them, here, but on the brink of elsewhere, gazing out across the land as if a better world was still to come.